And the format is both Bozana and Paul will speak for 10 to 15 minutes each, and that will leave some good time for questions at the end. Just to introduce the two speakers, so Bozana will speak first. I'm sure Bozana is very familiar to everyone. She was the president in 2010, and you've no doubt seen her on a variety of institute committees over time. Bozana is at Ernst & Young. She's got 20 years in life insurance and wealth management industry, and worked in a variety of different roles on pricing, valuation, experience investigations, and claim analysis. And Paul is a colleague. Paul Luce is a colleague of Bozana's at Ernst & Young. He works in a practice that helps clients improve their sales and service delivery performance. He's got 25 years of experience, and he's worked with contact centres, branches, field forces, back office processing centres, and across a wide range of different industries, including banking, insurance, government, telecommunications, and utilities. And Paul is also a keen yachtsman, regularly competes in sailing comps in Sydney around with the Cruising Yacht Club in Sydney. I did ask Bozana whether she had any hobbies, and she shared with me that with four children, that was not really an option. Or if she did, they tend to be her children's hobbies. So with no further comments from me, I'll ask Bozana to come up and start the presentation.
Thank you, Rob. So hello, everyone. Thanks for coming along today. I'm sorry about the mix-up in the session names that we had, but I'm glad to see that you've all navigated that and able to get along. So what we're here today to talk about is whether it's time to rethink customer relationships. We've all come to this conference to think big, and the key message we're challenging with today is that things are changing. And so what does this mean for you? We know consumers are changing. There's a whole set of things going on in the world that are driving us to change. We've got changes in technology. We've got the internet, voicemail, mobile phones, Facebook. We've got greater and fast access to information, ease and speed. And we've got changes in our regulatory environment, FOFA, for example, which is driving the transparency of advice. We've got economic uncertainty, the GFC, the Euro crisis, and this means that consumers are focused on insurer strength and relationships. So what are the implications of this for insurers? We need to listen to what consumers are saying. So across the globe, we've carried out a survey covering 24,000 customers, including 9,000 customers of life and personal lines insurance. And these have been spread over 7 global regions and 23 markets. And this included 1,000 customers in Australia. We believe this survey is the biggest of its kind. So why did we do this? We were listening to the voice of the consumers. We wanted to understand the changes that were happening in the market. We wanted to help insurers determine how to adapt, to attract, to deepen, and to preserve their customer relationships. So based on our research, we came up with 5 myths, which we set out to explore. And these myths fall into 3 broad areas. And the first myth relates to the overall perceptions of the industry. The second, third, and fourth myth relate to customer buying behaviour. And the last myth relates to customer persistency and retention. And I'm going to talk today about the overall industry perception, myth one, and then hand over to Paul, who's going to talk about customer buying behaviour, myths 2, 3, and 4, and then I'll cover retention, myth 5, and then a wrap-up of what this all could mean for you. So the first myth we set out to explore was that consumer confidence in the industry is low. And to answer this question, we looked at 3 things. First, the general perception of the industry. Next, whether the industry is ahead or behind other industries. And this is important as we don't set expectations by other insurers, but by frequent flyer schemes, credit card providers, hotel loyalty schemes, mobile phone companies, flybys. All these other programs tell their customers that they're important. But what do insurers do? And the third area that we looked at was the attitudes customers have towards the product that they hold. we found that consumers are ambivalent towards the industry. There's definite room for improvement. Consumers think insurers are lagging behind the experiences they're getting from other organisations. There are a significant number of people with a negative view of the industry. They get frequent flyer points, but what do they get from the insurance industry? However, 80% are happy with the product that they've got. Therefore, there's this odd tension. Consumers have got a negative view of the industry, but they're happy with their own product. I'm okay, it's just everyone else with a problem. So what does this tell us about the insurance industry? It's pointing to a public relations issue. Now compare this Australian story to other parts of the world. Australian consumers have a much more unfavourable view of the world than others in the Asia-Pacific region. Again, our industry is no good, but I have a great product that's meeting my needs. It's also worth pointing out at this stage that the life industry is doing a lot better than the general insurance industry in terms of perception. For general insurance, when we did this study at the end of last year, a far higher proportion of customers were negative about the industry. And if you think about the timing of the survey, which is after the Queensland hurricane and the widespread flooding that we'd have, there'd been a lot more negative press about the general insurance industry in terms of the cover provided. And so the negative reaction was hardly surprising. Now let's look a bit more about what customers are telling about what they're unhappy about. We started to dig into why customers have the feelings that they do about their insurance company. And generally, it came down to a couple of key areas. Now, we've all heard this before, but the key issue is product complexity. Product complexity is that consumers have trouble understanding what their products are and what they can do. The theme that came out was about how you navigate this product complexity. The themes or concerns are largely about communication. Consumers wanted to understand, to cut through the complexity. And what we saw in overseas markets, where a number of the products had a strong investment component, was that there were questions about the investment performance of the product. However, in Australia, what we're seeing is consumers wanted more communication around their products. The complexity of the product means you need clear communications. Consumers wanted to be able to access the information they need when they have questions. And this outcome was showed up by people saying that they wanted a named contact to deal with, or they wanted better online access to information and services. The overall theme that was coming through was that customers wanted clarity of communication and ease of access. And these factors are the fundamental reasons for the negativity in the industry. So what's this really saying? It's all about communication. As an industry, we're not communicating well with our customers. Our products are complex. Customers don't understand them. And it's difficult for our customers to access the information they need about their products. So our customers want simple products they can understand and accessible and clear communication. And I'll now hand over to Paul, who's going to talk about customer buying behaviour.
Thank you very much. Amidst all this complexity, as we talked to most of our clients around the world, it became very clear that this myth that life insurance is sold and not bought was very widely held. The idea that prospective customers don't go out and suddenly identify that they want to go out and buy life insurance, it is actually something they have to engage with, get advised on, and actually get led down the path to purchase. But that, in a world where people are taking far more control of their own destiny, that didn't really sit well with us. So this was a key hypothesis we went out to test. And what we were asking people was, how much research did you personally do when you went out to buy your life insurance policy or life insurance product, and how important was that to you? And what came out clearly looking backwards was that 38% of people were saying, yeah, I personally did a lot of research, which means people are taking control of their own future and what they want to buy and the products they're going to buy. And that, and they were also saying that research was very important to me in my buying decision. What was very stark, though, was when we now said, as you look forward and you make your next purchases, how much research will you do? And that number went up dramatically. That number went up to about 75%, went up to over 70%. So moving from 38% to 70%, people saying, I am personally going to go and do a lot of research before I go and speak to an advisor or a planner about my life insurance. So people are going to be walking in to the discussions they have with being a lot better informed than they have been in the past. Now we ask the question, where are they going to do that research? Where are they going to get this information? And again, looking backwards, what we saw was people were saying, I get it from my advisor, I'll get it from my friends, I'll get it from my family, I'll get it from brochures coming out from the life insurance, from the insurers. Looking forward, no surprise here, a huge shift towards online sources. So what we're seeing now are, firstly, people are doing a lot more research themselves, and secondly, they're actually turning primarily to online sources to get that information, to actually choose who are the insurers they're going to put into their consideration set as they start to make those investments. Then here in Australia, we said, well, what about, how visible are the insurers when it comes to these online searches that people are making? Firstly, just put this in perspective. Every month there are over 30,000 searches made using terms related to life insurance on Google. So there's a lot of activity out there. A lot of people are doing this research. And then the question is, well, if you do that research, which companies pop up to the top of the list that make you think, who will I go and talk to? What this graph is showing is exactly that. The line is looking at between October 2011 and February 2012 across the bottom axis, and it's saying how often do certain insurers come and appear in the first page of Google searches. So the ones at the top, there, that the blue line right at the top, that's around about 80% of the time, is saying life broker will appear 80% of the time when you search for life insurance terms. The other ones that appear quite predominantly, Allianz and Real Insurance, all out there. Those are the ones you see. So if you've done the research, those are the names that will pop up. The other interesting one is the Suncorp Group. Suncorp, as a group, appears very heavily. You'll see the Suncorp brand, you'll see the GIO brand, and you'll see the AMI brand, all appearing on that first page of search terms for life insurance. Now you look, where are the traditional life insurance players that we've seen? They're typically buried down on the fourth and the fifth page. So down the bottom there you see Zurich, MLC, OnePath, AMP AXA, CommInsure. At the moment, not visible at all. So the question you ask yourself, you now have prospective buyers doing a lot of research themselves. You see they're saying that research is important and influences their choice, and they're turning to online sources, but many of those players are not visible. Question for you, what's the implications for that for customer acquisition? So now as we move on, the next area we started to look at was the whole question of personal interaction. And we heard our speakers before saying that personal interaction is important. And the survey reinforced that people have a need to get that, to cut through the complexity, to answer their questions, to cut through all this terminology we use in the industry that makes it difficult for people to understand what actually it is they're buying and what they actually need. So they get the reassurance from talking to someone and getting that advice. We asked them why. Yes, and it became, I need expert assistance because it's a big decision for me. This is the future of my family if I'm not around. So it's a big decision. I want to make sure that's actually right. But hey, products are way too complicated. I can't understand them, so I need personal advice. And I really don't know of this plethora of products out there and the terminology which one's really best. So I need to talk to someone. And generally, in Australia, we were, people were saying, when I do talk to someone, I'm actually quite happy with the advice I get. And they're level, and they're comfortable with the level of personal contact. But now let's drill in a little more and say, when we say personal contact, what do customers actually mean? We have a preconceived idea that this does mean sitting down with an advisor across a table over a coffee and going through a traditional advice process. But this isn't actually the case. In line with the shift towards online channels, people are also saying, personal interaction for me doesn't have to be face-to-face. It can be equally by phone. The diagrams there are showing when you ask the people what were their preferred channels for personal interaction or interaction with their provider, 29% said, actually, my first choice is phone. So what this is telling us is that, yes, people want personal interaction to cut through the complexity. Until we can get simple products out there, that complexity is still going to be there. But they're going to cut through that complexity, and they're going to need advice. But they're quite happy to get that advice over the phone. In person, yes, they're quite happy to get that. But also through web chat. So lots of ways now are open that as providers you can respond to the need for personal interaction by using non-traditional channels. And again, we heard our speakers before talk about there will be a change in the advice market for video conferencing based, web chat based, phone based, and this is reinforcing that and saying this is the case. It isn't only the economics that are driving that; it really is a customer need. If we all look out to our children and how they spend their time, they're quite happy chatting away on Facebook and get advice from all sorts of places that we probably wouldn't normally look. Finally, we start talking a little bit about now the whole myth around buying multiple products. Saying people do not want to buy multiple. The myth is it's really hard to get cross sell. We know it's the holy grail. We know that this is the way that we as businesses can actually drive up our profitability. And Australia, in line with much of the other developed world, was showing that about 13% of customers said, "Yeah, I have bought more than one product from my insurer." That compares the US and the UK are at about 11%. So we're in the ballpark. There is a stark difference, so when you look across the rest of Asia Pacific, as to you see China, where they're saying, I've got 52% of people saying I've bought more than one product. Now, there are some structural reasons for that. For those of you who are familiar with the Chinese market, you'll know you can insure against some very, very specific risks. You know, a risk of being injured when you fall off a motorbike as being different from when you fall downstairs. So this drives a plethora of products, so people have large amounts of products they have out there. But so some people do buy. When we ask ourselves why? Why do people, when they do buy, despite all the difficulties, what is it that makes them want to buy multiple products? And when we looked at that, and I apologise, some of these graphs aren't all that easy to understand or be able to read, but the key factors that came out were, I want it to be, if it's easier to buy multiple products from one provider, I will. If I trust the provider, I will. And if there's some financial incentive for me to do so, I will. So what that's pointing to, I'd encourage you now to all go back to, as you think about your own businesses, and say, if you as a business do want to sell multiple products to your customers, to your policyholders, how convenient do you make it for them? How much do they trust you? And how much do you actually make it worth their while to put their business to you? And go through those and just think through those questions and say, and that might start to give you some indication as to how well or how badly you're doing in key segments of your population. So key implications for insurers here is you do have a lot of data that you can use data, both your own data and external data, and we could talk a lot more about what data is available now, but we don't really have time, but use analytics to start to help you make the right offers to people at the right time. We're seeing overseas increasingly the use of social media data, Facebook data, publicly available data that can inform about changes in family circumstance, that can make it very... It's not your data, but it's publicly available, that allows you then to make an offer that may be relevant for a new baby arriving or a moving of a house. There's complexity with cross-sell, particularly in our heavily intermediated market here. So there is some work to be done on sorting out the access protocols through intermediaries. But overall, to get cross-sell to work, you need to provide a high level of convenience and to behave in a trusted way and make it worth their while. So that's talked about how we get the customers. I'll hand over now back to Davina to talk about how we keep them.
Thanks, Paul. Our final myth is that providers can't materially influence persistency. We've found that customers think insurers put little effort into looking after them. And looking at the data, only 12% of customers actually plan to change providers within the next 5 years. And there are two points here. One, this represents a large inertia factor. Only 12% over 5 years. Most people don't want to change. And secondly, we know that many more customers than this actually do lapse. So why did this occur? We found the key reasons for customers lapsing was that advisors had recommended a change. You can see this from the top yellow bar in this graph here, though you'll be able to see it better on the printouts later. We found that 63% of those that left said that their current insurer had made little or no effort to keep them. This is a real action point. Even though churn is going to happen, often your customers think that you're not even trying to do anything about it. Customers think you're doing nothing. And we also found that this was an area where Australia really lagged behind other countries in the Asia Pacific region. Elsewhere, there was a much stronger effort to retain customers. So providers can influence persistency. Customers want their providers to give them a reason to stay. So given this is the case, there's a huge opportunity for providers to just start doing something, anything, about retention. And what should this action be? The first thing providers can do to address a retention issue is at the start of the cycle. Make sure you're writing good business. Think about how your products are being sold. Are particular intermediaries causing churn in the first place? We've helped a number of insurers in this area, and the results have been surprising. In one case, we found that the top performing agent who sold the most new business also had the highest level of churn. Customers were lapsing and re-entering once that initial 2-year customer responsibility period had ended. So check your definition of new business, make sure agents are given the right incentives to perform, and make sure persistency is a metric for your intermediaries. You've got to focus your business development efforts on those advisors who write business that stays rather than customers that churn. So you need to make sure you're writing good new business. The next step you can take is managing your customer relationships. Focus on the overall profitability of the customer, not the policy. Look at the entire collection of policies that each customer holds with you to determine which customers you really want to focus your effort into keeping. And if you analyse the whole customer book, we're able to, with a high degree of confidence, predict who's going to lapse. We've been able to build predictive models based on the key lapse drivers, identifying the flags to look for to indicate potential lapses. You need to make sure you understand your customers and what drives them. Identify those customers that are of most value to you. And once you've identified the customers you want to keep, then you can be proactive and reach out to them before a lapse actually occurs. Now, it's difficult logistically to do this with all customers, so it's important to target the high-value, high-risk ones first. And as Paul mentioned, you can actually enrich your existing data by matching it up with other external information, perhaps from a bank account or from bank account transactions or other social media sites. And you can, through that, identify if your customers have bought a house or had a child or got married, and then you can use these triggers to proactively target your profitable customers. and this, you can offer them then opportunities to increase their insurance or to take out an additional product. You can set up an outbound customer retention team to make contact with your customers. And this way you can actually listen to what your customers are saying and stop a lapse before it occurs. You can define a set of rules enabling you to take action depending on the value of the customer to you. And this could be offering a different product or an upgrade to the latest product version or even a premium freeze or a premium holiday. The action you take will depend on the value of the customer to you. You need to know your customers and determine how you can reach out to them. And the third action area we have after writing good new business and managing your customer relationships is if your customers actually do lapse, make sure you respond. If you've analysed your customer profitability and identified the customers that you want to keep, then you can make suitable offers to ideally try and reinstate that business. You can take action to reach out to those customers. So today, we've looked at the five myths that could be driving your relationship with customers. And what conclusions can we draw from this? We can see that, firstly, customers want a direct capability. Buying behaviours are changing, they are moving, and we are going to see an increasing amount of direct activity in the buying process. And we've also heard that this is not all about being online. Customers still do want personal interaction, though personal interaction does not necessarily mean face-to-face. So the key here now for you as providers is, what direct capability do you have and what do you still need to develop to respond to this change in buying behaviour? For many insurers, this means that you might need to build a direct capability. This means making sure you've got simple products, making sure you're visible online, being easy to contact by using call centres or the phone or the web. Make sure you have your distribution channels working together. Consider a direct capability to respond to changing customer demands. The second key point we've made is in relation to retention. We're expecting to see an increase in lapses. Customers have told insurers that they're not being given any particular reason to stay around. Customers don't feel loved by their insurers. They want some recognition and reward for their loyalty. So the question for you as insurers is, how are you responding to that? What do you need to put in place in terms of capability to actually retain customers? Consider if you're acquiring good business. Analyse and understand your customers to identify those at risk at lapsing. Do you need to set up an outbound call centre to reach out to your high-value, high-risk customers? What is your strategy to retain the customers that you want to retain? These messages from our customers have implications for products, for distribution, and for your administration functions. So listen to the voice of the customer, or else pay the price. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Bazan and Paula. Now I've got your microphone so you can answer questions.
Thanks, Rob.
So now we need some questions. For Julia's just grabbing another microphone. So if you put your hand up, she'll find you and you can then ask a question. We got a hand up the front, Julia. And if you could just give us your name before you start asking your question.
Hi, my name is Nip, and my question, I was curious with the using data from bank and social media to approach customers, and I was curious as to whether there were results about how favourably customers viewed those approaches, like, oh, I've just realised you've had a baby, and would you like more insurance? Obviously, it wouldn't be like that, but I'm curious as to what sort of reaction customers might have had to that sort of thing.
Obviously, you've got to be very careful with how you use customer data like that. Sometimes customers can actually really appreciate the approach if they're in that situation, perhaps just a new baby, and you don't have time to go and think about the fact that this would be a good time to get insurance or how on earth am I going to find an insurer. You already heard earlier today about the difficulties of finding an insurer. So if someone can actually approach you with a reasonable offer that matches your needs, you can take that really favourably. You have to also be careful of the whole privacy situation. Sometimes people can think it's a turn off if someone's stalking them and knowing their every move. So it is a balancing act that insurers have to tread, but this is the way of the future. If you look in the Facebook age, more and more people are putting their personal information online, and are, well, it's there for everyone to read and see.
I think it's fair to say that I think we've got a window of opportunity at the moment, that a lot of data is out there right now. And Bettina's right, it's very much how the interaction is made and how the offer is made. A number of these proactive outbound offers can often be framed, particularly to your existing customer base, as a service call. That is a needs identified, and it's done as very much a soft sell approach. But that window of opportunity we have now, while I think the rules in terms of the use of this public data are still being developed, do provide a window of opportunity, particularly if you look at, and I think probably Spain is one of the countries that you should look at as to where this is probably being done the most, and how this information is being used. So that window may close shortly, but it's then. But it all comes down to really the way the offer is made, and it's certainly it's clearly more risky if doing it for a non-customer than for an on-sell or an upsell for a service, essentially servicing your existing customer base.
Juliet, just behind you, back.
Jeff Peck from Russell Investments. I actually have a fair bit of insurance, and I'm interested in your view about how the insurer can go about owning the customers. When insurance is distributed through, you know, advisors or super funds or things like that, how do you get to a point where you feel you own the customer sufficiently to contact them proactively when you've got these different distribution models?
I think you've raised a really interesting point there, Jeff, and I know in the past, or perhaps currently as well, advisors feel as though they own the customer and want to have that relation exclusively with the customer. But the customer is moving away from that. The customer actually wants the relationship not only with the provider now, but also with the insurer. So it's a bit of a transition phase, and sometimes the advisor is resisting that. So you have to manage carefully around that advisor process. But I don't have an easy answer how we're going to do that. The danger is if the insurer doesn't start initiating that relationship directly with the customer, which is what the customer wants, they're missing an opportunity, and they're not the person who, or the company who is able to start initiating that relationship will be the one that will capitalise on that opportunity. Did you want to add to that? Yeah.
Unfortunately, Jeff, you took my question from me, but well done, it's a good question. I just a quick, maybe common stroke question for myself, which is I find it quite interesting that the company I'm with, TAL, did not appear in the search list, and I kind of know why, but it was quite intriguing. And I'm maybe this is a more common question, but if you could respond, is how can we expect our customers to contact us if they're thinking of changing provider if they can't find us? And yeah, I thought that was quite an interesting point that occurred to me.
The good news, Rob, is that Insurance Line did actually come up towards the bottom of the page when I did my search on the weekend. So it's a real challenge. I know when we first started doing this research, obviously we're building on data that had been collected over quite a period. So I was amazed when I saw these results, and I actually came across it a year or two ago when I was doing some research into direct insurance. And I was trying to work out what direct products each of the major insurers had, and I got quite frustrated because the only names that were coming up were these companies I'd never heard of, you know, Real and the aggregator sites and Choosy and iSelect and LifeBroker. And I wanted to come across AMP and MLC and Zurich and TAL and all that kind of stuff, and they weren't there. But then I realised that this is the new market, and these are the companies who are out there, and these are the ones who are going to be winning the business and having the relationship with the consumers. And anyone who wants to try and get life insurance now, they try and Google it, which is the natural way. These are the companies are going to be choosing. They're going to go through those aggregator sites, seeing what comes up, or going through Real Insurance that comes up right there, because they're the names that are in front of people. And the traditional players, if they want to be competitive in that space, then they need to make sure that their names are found.
You can actually pay Google to have your company come up first.
Well, that's right. And so I guess you know the ones who are paying because they come up.
Can I just make a point on that one? All those results were for the organic searches. So it wasn't for AdWords-based searches. So those results are not paid for advertising. It's actually based on their search engine optimization efforts that they've actually done. I think the other area that came up, was where you did, say you found an insurer, you then often tried to call up the call centre, right? Now, very rarely will a customer say there and then, right, yeah, I'll buy. There's normally reasons as they'll go through an extended buying cycle. We tested this for a number of the insurers, and I think the norm was if we got a call back at all, perhaps it might be in about 10 days. It was absolutely horrendous. So I think the thing that's coming out from here is you need to get visible. You need to recognise how customers are buying and how customers are moving through their buying cycles, and that they may start on the web, they may move to a call centre, and they may then actually end up moving out to an advisor for a particular, because you, as they talk to people, they may find their needs are broader and you need to move to a more holistic advice model. But it's really how you stitch those things together. We've been doing, so there's been some interesting work going on quite recently on how you decide as a lead comes in where you should allocate it to. And this is a way that, and this is an area that actually changes the dynamic between the provider and even the planner partners. There will be some customers who, based on who they are, what they want to buy, what their background is, a bit of their profiling, they're more likely to close with a certain advisor than another advisor. So if they're currently unserved, if we're finding that increasingly both here, people are starting to do smart lead allocation algorithms that actually direct the lead to the channel and the people that it's actually most likely to close with. And we've seen some of the most advanced work, surprisingly, on this has been done in South Africa, where this allocation of leads is really changing the way and drives a significant uplift in the sales conversion rates, but also how adds a whole element of partnering with and changes the dynamic and the partnering relationship between you and the planners. So you can start to see the planners as not your customers, but your partners in addressing your end customers. So a lot of interesting work's going on here, that things that I think we will see some quite dramatic changes as we move forward.
I think there's time for one more question if someone wants to proffer something.
Hi, Rod Berry. I guess just interested with the retention and the clients are saying that nobody contacted them to persuade them not to change their policy. Did you do any research on how effective, so those who did make that contact, how effective the contact was, whether the customer changed their mind or not about switching?
We didn't do any in this study itself. However, over the last few years, we've done quite a lot of work with a number of the providers on actually putting in place proactive and reactive retention programs. Proactive retention programs are very effective if executed well, but we did see a huge variation in how well they were implemented, and that might be for a whole number of reasons. One reason was the outbound ability to be, the technology and ability you have to be able to go out and contact customers, that had created a high variability, particularly in terms of productivity. Other some organisations are outsourcing that outbound contact element, and that changed a bit as well. So a lot of variability, far more effective on the proactive side than the reactive side. So it's just playing to the point. You need to be able to anticipate rather than respond.
And on that proactive side, we've done a number of assignments across this, and we found that we've been able to reduce the lapse rates by 1 percentage point. So if your lapse rate was 12%, reduce it down to 11%, and that's been an across-the-board reduction. So it's actually quite significant if you actually do undertake some of these strategies in order to reduce your lapse rates.
Well, thanks, Bazan and Paul, for a great presentation. If you'd like to maybe join me in the normal manner.